From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Chidanand Rajgata. He's foreign editor of The Times of India. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Richard Rosso. He's senior fellow and Wadhwani chair in U.S.-India policy studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, and that's a prominent think tank based here in Washington. We'll be discussing the significance and implications of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's official visit to Washington, his fourth in 2 years. Prime Minister Modi's visit this past week is a testament to the growing ties between the world's largest democracy and the United States. India is a key country for Washington, given tensions with Pakistan and New Delhi's status as a bulwark against China. President Obama, who has visited India twice during his term in office, calls the bilateral relationship one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century. Stronger links began under former Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and deepened throughout the Obama years. Modi's visit serves to strengthen the burgeoning ties in the areas of trade, combating terrorism, and climate change. Washington and New Delhi agreed to move ahead with the construction of 6 nuclear reactors in India by an American company, Westinghouse Electric, the first such move since the nation signed a landmark civil nuclear deal in 2008. In addition, Prime Minister Modi said New Delhi plans to formally join the Paris Climate Agreement this year, a historic move by the world's fastest-growing emitter of greenhouse gases. It's a key step toward full implementation of this far-reaching accord. The Prime Minister capped his visit by addressing a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, the fifth delivered by an Indian head of government to the U.S. legislature. We'll talk about the significance and impact of his visit to Washington and the implications of the growing U.S.-India partnership with Richard Rosso, who joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
And I'm delighted to welcome to the panel the foreign editor of The Times of India, Chidanand Rajgata, better known as Chidu. Chidu, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, Richard, let's get right to this U.S.-India partnership and impact of Prime Minister Modi's visit. This is the fourth to the United States in a span of 2 years, his seventh meeting with President Obama since Obama assumed office. Talk about the significance of this particular visit. Why did he come now? And how do you see the relations between the United States and India?
Well, I think since Prime Minister Modi took over the country 2 years back, relations have really been picking up again. There was a down period just before his election due to a variety of trade issues, the inability for the previous government to follow through on some strategic commitments that we'd made, and most significantly, I think, with the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York. And so seeing Modi come to office, having him articulate an economic and a security vision that seemed more aligned with ours, the United States really began to pick up relations with India. More so on the defense and security relation, I think you can point to some real tangible benefits from that. A little bit less on the econ front, although you still see an uptick in trade and investment since Prime Minister Modi came in. The significance of the visit at this time, you know, some people are saying so close to the end of the administration, you know, what can possibly happen? I think, you know, they wanted to use this as an opportunity to try to close the loop on some of the existing work streams that have been initiated the last couple of years. But also for President Obama and knowing that his term is coming to an end, they want to throw a few anchors onto the other side of this election to make sure that policy initiatives that are important to the Obama administration, particularly on clean energy and environment, to make sure that there's some anchors that exist on the other side of this election and that some of those policies have a better chance of being carried through by the next administration. So close the loop on some things that they've initiated and throw some anchors on the other side of the election so that some of the policies will hopefully be continued.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the calculation was that if you waited until the next administration, you know, typically U.S. administrations take at least a year to settle in, actually, for, you know, confirmations for officials to be in place. So the idea was to come in and, you know, it was not just a goodbye visit, but also have some kind of continuity. And an important part of that was addressing the Congress. Very clearly on this visit, there was an emphasis on Congress, considering the number of engagements he had there and the time he spent there. And it's known that in the U.S., despite changes in the executive, the Congress, even if it changed hands, 90% of Congress is reelected every election, 90%. It doesn't happen in too many countries, but that's the way the system is rigged. And I think he made a fairly strenuous outreach there on the Hill. So the idea is to continue. There's been a progressive incremental improvement of relations. And I think if he hadn't come now, there'd have been a year and a half or 2 years of lag before things started picking up again.
Chidu Rajgata, foreign editor of the Times of India, thank you for your contribution. And let me turn back to you, Richard, because Chidu mentioned that Prime Minister Modi made an address to Congress. He was extremely charming. He used lots of humor. We can talk about some of those quips later in the program. But he used the word in his address to Congress that India and the United States are natural allies. Now, that ally word really struck me because the ambassador of India to the United States uses the word strategic partnership. He shies away from the use of the word allies. So I wanted you to parse that a bit for us. Are we allies in the traditional sense, or, you know, how would you characterize the relationship today, given the rise of China? And many are saying, you know, that this is why the United States and India really need to come together to counter the rise of China, and that's one of the underlying reasons.
It's a great question. You know, I do recognize words clearly have meaning, and to articulate what the vision looks like and try to capture that in a word can be a very powerful thing. But at the same time, you know, actions have far more meaning. And so when we talk about what is the status of the relationship, I judge it less by the last word that a leader used and more so on what are the actual things that we're doing together or talking about doing together. And let me just talk about a few things on the defense and strategic front that you've seen take place in recent years. Most importantly, last year in January, when President Obama visited India, we released a document called the Joint Strategic Vision for the Asia-Pacific and Indian Ocean region. This is a 1.5-page document of shared security principles for Asia. And it talks about freedom of navigation, overflight, all the kind of things that we see, you know, China taking an increasingly aggressive posture throughout Asia. To imagine 15, 20 years ago, the United States and India having a shared security vision for Asia, impossible. And yet last year they released it. Second, we updated our defense framework agreement that really sets the structure for the things that our militaries do together. And that was released the middle of last year. Also, the United States and India, and this is, I think, for the United States perspective, the closest way to deepen our partnership with India. India wants America's advanced defense technology. The United States doesn't just give that out. We give it to those countries that have a shared vision and are willing to do things that are aligned with American interests. And so we've begun a program called the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative. It only exists with India. There's a special team in the Pentagon called the India Rapid Reaction Cell. Again, that kind of thing only exists for India, which is trying to expedite technology development and cooperation with India, trying to reduce barriers to export controls. And we're working on a number of work programs right now to jointly develop next generation defense material, which, again, this is relatively novel. But for India, you know, it is a very different type of partnership. So you see tangible things.
Rick, I have a question here. Explain to us, is this the kind of exceptionalism that is being applied to India? Because even the nuclear deal, the U.S.-India civilian nuclear deal, was an exceptional event, an exceptional treaty. DTI sounds very much like that in the defense trade thing.
Yeah.
So in how many areas are they going to do this? And two, are all these little details, say the Westinghouse, are they all a part of a bigger sort of game plan?
Well, I think, you know, your first question on exceptionalism, yeah. I mean, we have been willing, I think, in some areas to make exceptions to some extent, to carve out special places for India that we haven't done for others. There's others that would like to be brought into the nuclear club, perhaps. I think we know one of India's prominent neighbors, Pakistan, would certainly love to be next in line to be brought into the fold for nuclear trade. You take a look at these defense initiatives, which I just announced. There's no country in the world that wouldn't love for the United States to come and say, let's jointly develop the next generation equipment. So ultimately, when we talk about the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative, the programs are things like chemical weapon suits or small power generators for forward base facilities. So
what about the big ticket items? What about the aircraft carrier, for instance?
That's right. We've initiated two working groups under the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative to look at sharing aircraft carrier technology with India and also to look at the co-development of jet engine technology. Now, aircraft carrier, I think, for power projection, which, of course, we want to see India not just grow to be able to defend itself, but to become a regional security provider, power projection is critical for that.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Richard Rosso. He's Senior Fellow and Wadhwani Chair in U.S.-India Policy Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about the U.S.-India partnership as Prime Minister Narendra Modi wraps up an important visit to Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is Chidanand Rajgata. He's the foreign editor of The Times of India. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Rahim Poya. He's a loyal fan from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Richard, because I want to pick up on a word you use, Pakistan. Pakistan would like to have a similar relationship on the civil nuclear side as India. But on the other hand, we know that India and Pakistan are still rivals. So many points of dispute over Afghanistan, over Kashmir. The Prime Minister mentioned in his address to Congress that we have to deepen our security cooperation and isolate those who harbor, support, and sponsor terrorists. We also have to de-link religion from terrorism. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard a subtext in there, like Pakistan. I want you to address that because the United States has a relationship with Pakistan, trying to work with Pakistan. They're a nuclear power. They have influence over Taliban, the Haqqani network that could help us create stability in Afghanistan. Talk about Pakistan's relationship to the United States and to what extent that's still a point of contention with India.
It's become, I think, a bit more prominent again in our relationship with India. I think in recent years, we really have been treating our relationship with Pakistan and India very differently. And in fact, National Security Council and State Department, they've kind of broken up the groups that cover those two regions. And, you know, as you rightly point out, security ultimately in Afghanistan, Pakistan is going to play a critical role in that. So for us to cut off relations with Pakistan at a time that we're trying to set Afghanistan in a better position for whatever decision we take in the future for our role in security in Afghanistan, you know, Pakistan is a part of that equation, whether we like it or not. And so, you know, maintaining relations with Pakistan to some extent is critical in that lens. I think a lot of people are questioning whether or not the United States could attenuate our relations differently, could make benefits that the United States gives Pakistan more tied to specific outcomes. That kind of is always out there. But with India, and particularly what you mentioned, you know, Prime Minister Modi also sort of thanked Congress for blocking the sale of F-16s to Pakistan.
I think something to the effect of the best way to, you know, handle this is to isolate them.
Don't give benefits to those that are.
But I also got the sense, Rick, that increasingly Pakistan has become marginalized and it has marginalized itself. And again, in briefings, U.S. officials told us that in the past, they would have 90% of the conversation might have centered around Pakistan. But this time it was fairly marginal. And in part, that also has to do with improved relations the U.S. is having with Iran. And one of the key things that happened just before Modi came to Washington was his visit to Iran and the Chabahar port deal, which on the face of it, it's a India-Iran-Afghan initiative to use that port. But it also gives the United States a second route into Afghanistan. What did you think of the Chabahar prelude to the whole visit?
Yeah. Very good question. I wanted to ask you that, too. Mm-hmm. Does that either irritate or does that perhaps doesn't really bother the United States, this increased and closer relationship between Iran and India?
You know, I think in recent years, before you saw a bit of a thaw in U.S.-Iran relations, India maintained connectivity. They kept talking about developments at Chabahar, right? This goes back more than a decade since they first articulated their interest in developing Chabahar. And also, India is a major oil importer from Iran. And India, you know, I think by and large, they've supported some U.S.-led resolutions, the U.N. Security Council. They also...
And the fact that the U.S. did not object specifically to the Chabahar thing before Modi came here.
Yeah. So I think, you know, you look back at years past when U.S.-Iran relations were chillier, India, I think, was responsive to American outreach to India in terms of isolating Iran, you know, reducing oil imports, talking less and doing less on Chabahar development, on voting with the United States on resolutions about Iran. And now that, you know, U.S.-Iran relations are strengthening somewhat for India
over the nuclear deal.
Deal. I think that would mean that we put less pressure against India for these kind of steps. Potentially, India could begin to import a bit. Also, I think we look at it and we say, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, Chabahar is a route into Afghanistan. And I think 2 or 3 years ago when I'd be in Delhi, most people were, at the time we were talking about ending the U.S. support, physical support, military support for Afghanistan. And the perception in Delhi by and large, I think at that time, and Chidu, you have a thought on this, was that Afghanistan would fall into civil war or disarray almost immediately. The fact that they're putting money and betting on Chabahar as an entry in Afghanistan is a bit of a signal, too, that maybe they're thinking there is a future in Afghanistan, which I think gives a lot of us a bit more energy right now. So it's important for a lot of reasons. Last thing I'll mention on the U.S.-India-Iran triangle, our relationship with India on the security side is very much about China. It is about Asian stability. Right. It's not about the Middle East. It's not about Russia. We didn't press India to say something dramatic after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I think we're also able to shoulder India balancing relations with some countries that we may not consider in our interest because we're keeping the vision, at least right now, on this partnership and its meaning for something else.
Yeah, and I found it interesting also, Rick, that after the Chabahar port agreement, I think people tried to set up Chabahar versus Gwadar, which is the port in Pakistan, which gives the Chinese access to warm waters. And the Chinese turned around and said, hey, we love Chabahar too. We can use that too. And I thought that was pretty significant.
Yeah, I think India probably looks at Chabahar development. And, you know, I think the Modi government is being very thoughtful in trying to counter moves that it's seen China having taken in recent years. You know, you talk about China and this grand pronouncement about developing this infrastructure corridor through Pakistan. If India can throw a wing on the other side of Pakistan and try to loop back around the other way, I mean, is Iran playing that game? Are they going to look at triangulating Pakistan? Probably not. But for Indian, I think, views, seeing that they have a stronger relationship on the other side strategically, you know, looks like an important thing to have done. You know, similarly, getting slightly off track, but on this idea about India countering things that they've seen China do, you look at all of Modi's foreign engagements since he came to office 2 years ago. And, you know, the one that intrigues me the most, and I sometimes refer to it as the Doolittle Raid. You remember that bombing that we did on Japan just after Pearl Harbor? We didn't have the ability to sustain a campaign against Japan's homeland at that time, but we sent a couple of bombers out there for one off mission. Modi, that trip that he took where he stopped in Korea and Mongolia on back-to-back visits.
Right.
Two Asian democracies, especially Mongolia. I mean, two major borders with Russia and China looking for friends.
I noticed that Secretary Kerry also stopped in Mongolia before he went to Beijing.
Yeah. You see India playing these steps. So for them, Chabahar, for them taking these steps towards other Asian democracies, just like China has been spending a lot of time and energy on India's neighbors, you can kind of see they're playing a different level of game strategically. It appears like a non-event. Most people don't talk about the Korea-Mongolia stops. But for me, very significant in terms of showing that they're playing the chess game rather than checkers.
Chess game, in other words, to try to
counter the moves that China's made, surrounding them, engaging with their neighbors, things like that.
And of course, that delights the United States.
Here's something that was very striking for me, Rick. Modi comes to Washington, D.C., and his first stop, I thought it was very significant, is going to Arlington. Now, this is from the prime minister of a country which has consistently opposed many of American wars, which they regard as adventurism. In his address to the Congress, too, he mentioned it, and he said this was to honor the soldiers who gave up their life for the cause of democracy, etc. And I know that there'll be many Americans on the left of center who'd have reservations about American wars in Iraq and so on. But I thought that was an important signal. And, you know, this is from a country which has had a record of opposing U.S. interventions the world over.
The quintessentially non-aligned country.
And I thought to myself, my God, Mrs. Nehru, Gandhi, Rajiv Gandhi, Indira Gandhi would be rolling in their graves saying, what are you doing?
When I heard that, too, I mean, I was thinking a bit more about the contributions made by American troops during World War II. And that's when he stopped for a moment and actually applauded the Americans sitting in the audience.
Right, yeah.
And taking my think tank hat off as an American sitting there and knowing that sometimes our interventions overseas actually result in things that people look at as good, it warms the heart a little bit, but probably fuels us for our next intervention someplace.
Yeah, hey, there's a striking bit of irony or granite in this case. I noted a couple of weeks back in a piece before the visit. Do you know the Vietnam Memorial, the black granite? Do you know where that comes from?
No.
Comes from my hometown, Bangalore in India.
How does it?
All of it. It was the early 80s when India had problems with Reagan's America. It wasn't exactly a happy relationship in the early 80s before Mrs. Gandhi and Rajiv Gandhi came. The trade doesn't stop. And the other thing that has never stopped, which is very significant and important for all of Modi's initiatives, is the movement of people. Throughout the bad days between India and U.S., Indian doctors and engineers have always come to the United States. And
speaking of which, you know, we're talking about a huge diaspora here, 3 million Indian Americans here in the United States, which comprise a major bridge between India and the United States.
Yeah, it's terrific. I mean, you look up in the audience and you saw the CEOs of MasterCard and PepsiCo. Chidu, of course, is the great expert for following the American Spelling Bee champions. He writes about this often.
In fact, I thought it was very interesting that the people who went to receive Modi at the airport, right now the U.S. ambassador to India is Indian-American and the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia is an Indian-American. You couldn't even have imagined this 20 years ago.
I think the BJP, too, they are more comfortable embracing the diaspora. Congress, is it because they feel that these folks had left their country, you know, a lot of them going to these primary institutions that Congress had set up, whatever the reason? You know, the BJP, when they were in office last time, they set up the first global forum to bring the diaspora back once a year to sort of celebrate their achievements. A lot of folks, including the Wadhwani Foundation, that is a big supporter of my chair at CSIS, a lot of those primary Indian American foundations were launched at that time because they really felt they can get traction back home and start doing things. So I think that's a theme that you saw a bit more during the Vajpayee regime as well. It was sustained during the Singh regime. Yeah.
You're right. And, you know, it's the BJP's specialty. I'd like to say they tapped in very successfully into absentee nationalism. There's a huge diaspora, which has very strong feelings about India, and they've tapped into it much better than the Congress party did.
The presence of this diaspora can only help strengthen ties between people-to-people ties, as Prime Minister Modi put it, between the United States and India.
I also like to point out, Carol, that there are about 3.2 million people of Indian origin in the United States. That's more Indians in one country as permanent residents than in any other country, not even Britain, much less Russia, China, where there are so many Indians present, one. And two, Indian Americans in this country are the highest earning ethnic group by far. Household family income is 100,000 plus. There's not even any other ethnic group nearby. Taiwanese Americans are the second highest at, I think, 85,000 household income.
And of course, Modi said in his address to Congress, as you said, you know, CEOs, academics, doctors, astronauts, spelling bee champs, as we said.
Rick can tell us about the think tank presence now.
That's
working out in the think tanks, Rick?
Yeah, it's good.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't address another very important theme of the meetings and accomplishments, Rick, and that is the climate agreement. The fact that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said that New Delhi aims to formally join the Paris Climate Agreement this year, and that's considered an important historic move.
Yeah, you kind of watch, and clearly for the Obama administration, apart even from Paris, trying to do things, develop more efficiently, more cleanly than the United States and a lot of other countries were able to. You know, I look at this and I see one big hole in this narrative, though, which is in India, you know, so much of what we talk about on this is the forms of energy production. And for the most part, in India, that topic is guided by state leaders. And Prime Minister Modi only has limited influence in getting states to take decisions on their electric power grid. So certainly it's something that the Obama administration presses on, tries to offer, you know, small and medium-sized ways to support on. But these aren't decisions that are going to be made in bilaterals with the United States. There are 29 leaders in India of the states. They control the grids. Narendra Modi's party only controls 9 of those 29 states. So that's where the real decision-making has to take place. So for those kind of things, it's great that they put on paper here in Washington, but the real work has to happen back in India, and it's about Modi's ability to engage state leaders.
I noticed that in the fact sheet, they mentioned that the U.S. would have chief minister's conclave. I thought that was very interesting. Is there an outreach directly to the chief ministers? Is this one of the reasons for that?
They weren't thinking necessarily of clean energy when they came up with the idea of a chief minister's conclave. So in India, a chief minister is like a governor in the United States. But there is a governor in India. But ignore them. They're powerless.
Yeah, they're powerless. The chief minister is executive of the state.
When we talk about economic engagement under Modi, if this chief minister's conclave comes to light this summer, where you bring a number of American executives, senior U.S. federal officials, maybe some state officials, and sit across the table directly from Indian chief ministers, and for economic issues, for clean energy, the chief ministers have a lot more power and influence than Prime Minister Modi does. Nobody knows what's going to come of such an engagement, but at least getting the right people at the table is a critical first step. So I agree. Not everybody paid attention. Chief Minister's Conclave sounds kind of dull. But in practice, that's one of the few opportunities to bring everybody at the table at the same time that can actually move the needle, both on India's ease of doing business, on clean energy, things like that. So I don't yet know that they have precision on what that meeting is going to look like, which chief ministers will show up, who's going to be representing on the U.S. side of the table. But I'm glad that you saw that. Certainly bringing the right people to the table, which is just as important as having the right topics.
Rick, before we close, what is the significance of the fact that the United States endorsed India's bid to join the nuclear suppliers group? What privilege and responsibility does this entail?
It isn't the first time that we've articulated our support for India to join the global nonproliferation regimes. Getting in would allow India access to more material that is restricted right now. There's, you know, for nuclear, for chemicals, for security, for missile control. There's various nonproliferation regimes. The United States has articulated support before. But the question is, you know, do we verbally support it and write that on a piece of paper? Or, you know, with Secretary of State John Kerry in Beijing this week, is he busy using whatever tools he has at his disposal to make sure that China removes its block on India's entry into the nuclear suppliers group? The articulation of support isn't necessarily novel, but the question is, what are we doing to make it happen? Because we've got tools to usher that. And how many of those are willing to deploy? And seeing so much progress in other areas of our security cooperation with India, that helps us make those decisions a little bit easier to use our full suite of tools.
Right. And I thought one of the tools that was deployed was to get India into what's called MTCR, the Missile Technology Control Regime, which is one of the four, you know, groups that India wants to get into. And the United States announced it just before Modi came to Washington that that part of business was taken care of and that India is now, for all purposes, a member of MTCR. Now, China is not a member of MTCR, so did not have the sort of veto that could have blocked it. But it was very clear that the U.S. shepherded India into the MTCR club. And it seemed to me that the U.S. was basically using the MTCR key, or battering ram, if you want to call it, to open the NSG doors. Because the core of the MTCR, the Missile Technology Group, are also members of the Nuclear Suppliers Group. So it was a signal to China that, look, India has a support of 34 members of the MTCR. So you're probably the, China's probably the only holdout. And I think U.S. officials said that it is their specific and stated objective to get India into the Nuclear Suppliers Group this year, in fact, this month, in the plenaries that's going to happen this month. And I thought that was an interesting signal. And all this, Rick, do you think all this adds up to India's grand ambition to be part of the high table by becoming a member of the reformed UN Security Council? You think this is where that's going?
Which, of course, President Obama, of course, has urged and suggested strongly that India have a seat at the UN Security Council.
And this gets back to support versus support. What President Obama said was he supported India's inclusion as part of a reformed UN Security Council, which could mean forever everybody's in, nobody's in. I mean, it's so very unclear what the reformed UN Security Council. So that's one of those agreements that can be rolled out several times because it sounds substantive, but also very squishy at the same time. You know, right now, again, we've got a lot of exercises we do with India. But ultimately, you know, for us seeing people at that high table, I think we need to see what are the actions, what are the operations India will undertake for regional security, because it isn't just about defense of the homeland that gets people excited. It's about countries that have a shared vision with the United States. And the danger in that, and I fully realize as an American, at some point we may tap India on the shoulder as our defense relations continue and saying, we've got this new enemy. All of our friends are coming to war against them with us. Will you join us? And if India is not yet prepared at that moment to say yes, this deck of cards that we've stood up right now could come crashing down. So I fully realize we're asking India to do very little right now on behalf, but that question will come.
My sense is India is never going to be able to do that because fundamentally the Indian foreign policy DNA is still, you know, non-aligned, as they call it, despite everything, despite all the words. It's too big a country to just roll over and say, all right, we'll sign up for any war you fight, unless it achieves Indian objectives. But Rick, I just wanted to throw out one question. What happens under a President Trump?
Well,
all bets are off.
Hypothetical.
Yeah, you know, I think India is not yet so important in American foreign policy or economic establishment where you have a mandate to spend time and work with India.
But will any foreign policy commitments hold firm under President Trump? I mean, he said so many things which are completely outrageous.
It all depends on the people that he appoints. Right. You know, the secretaries, the undersecretaries, the assistant secretaries. And we don't have any idea who those people are going to be because the usual group of advisors is a little more opaque right now.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if it's a President Clinton. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we have a little bit more clarity on that. She's shown that she has a deft touch with India. She engaged state leaders, visited often. So she's got a bit more of a track record in engaging India as secretary, as first lady. So, and we know there are advisors that are in there. It's people that we trust. So I think we have a bit more idea what that might look like.
Richard Rosso is Senior Fellow and Wadhwani Chair in U.S.-India Policy Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Rick, thanks very much for coming and sharing your insights about the U.S.-India partnership.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and joining me on the program was Chidanand Rajagata. He's foreign editor of the Times of India. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.